Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Ryan Free on behalf of Caroline Harris, trustee of the Edith Heineman Harris Trust.
I'm afraid I'm still seeing counsel from the other argument's faces on the screen and not counsel from this argument.
Oh, hold up. I can see Mr. Free and Mr. Wisen, but if you cannot, we need to get that repaired.
Okay.
Yeah, I can see them.
Okay, now I have them.
Yeah, you had frozen up for a minute, Judge Friedman, but you're now unfrozen.
Okay, now I see counsel in this case. I'm sorry to have interrupted.
Not at all. Please, any one of you, if there's any problem, sing out immediately so we can get it remedied. The IT guys are doing remarkable work, and we've been doing this now for over a year with great success. But if there's ever a glitch, I want to know immediately so we can make sure we don't miss a single word. Go right ahead, counsel. Feel free to start over if you want.
Again, for Judge Friedman's benefit, Brian Free, on behalf of Caroline Harris, as trustee for the Edith Heineman Harris Trust, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, this case involves fundamental issues of due process. Now, I want to start with two things.
So, I'm sorry to interrupt, counsel. Judge Kristen, I'm having significant trouble hearing Mr. Free. I don't know whether you are or not. I don't know if it's the distance between Mr. Free and his microphone or something on my end.
I'm having difficulty too.
Yeah, Mr. Free, you're sort of fading in and out. Sometimes I can hear you. Are you stepping forward and backward vis-a-vis a microphone?
I'll move closer. It works. T-step. Is this better?
Yes, but you're going to have to keep your voice up. This is not...
Okay.
Easy. Okay.
Please let me know if you cannot hear. This case involves fundamental issues of due process. And I'd like to begin with two basic legal principles, both of which were ignored by the Mundell Trust or in the New York action. The first is that the law distinguishes between legal entities. An LLC is not the same as a member. A corporation is not the same as a shareholder. And a husband is not the same as a wife, especially where she is acting as a trustee of a trust. The second legal principle is that to be bound, one must be part of a judicial proceeding. How is one brought into a judicial proceeding? One is named as a party and served as a party with a summons and a complaint.
Counsel, I have now decided that the problem is you're dropping your voice. You've got to keep your voice up, please.
Okay. I will do so. And here, all of the legal requirements that I've listed, the distinguishing between legal entities and the naming and serving of parties were ignored in the New York action by the Mundell Trust. Now, the Mundells would seek to sweep aside these as mere technicalities. They argue, well, it's the Harris family. It's the Harris family writ large, and so it's good enough. But these are not mere technicalities. These are fundamental due process. And the question in this case is who bears the error? Who bears the cost of the error that was made? Because an error was made. In the New York action, the Heineman Trust was never named as a party. Heineman Trust was never served as a party. It's also undisputed that the Heineman Trust has never been paid on the underlying note.
Never what?
Been paid.
But counsel, you don't dispute that when the arbitrator said that the Heineman Trust has put forth funds with an expectation of repayment and such outstanding balances shall be respected, you don't dispute that the arbitrator specifically gave credit without interest for the principal value of the notes, $277,884.34, right?
I don't dispute that credit was given. The question is, to whom? To whom was credit? And this gets at the heart of the issue. Because the Heineman Trust was not a party. And it is insufficient to say the Harris family received credit. Because the Harris family is not a legal entity. It's insufficient to say we have named Timothy Harris, and therefore, we can bind the Heineman Trust.
Well, it's not quite that, though, right? It's not quite that. It seems to me the district court here was very concerned with this litigation that had been pending for how many years in New York?
A number. Yeah.
quite a number,
yes.
More than a decade, if I recall correctly, right? And so there was Timothy, but then there was Lawrence, and Lawrence very helpfully volunteered these promissory notes, correct? Oops. Wait, did we lose Judge Friedman?
Yes.
Stop the clock, please. And Sam, we have lost Judge Friedman.
Hi, Judge. I'm going to give them a call. They should be reconnecting shortly, but I'll make sure.
Thanks very much. We'll wait.
I'm afraid I was gone for about 5 minutes.
We stopped the clock right away. We haven't.
Oh.
I don't think you missed much at all. Maybe a sentence or two.
Okay.
I had just asked. Did you hear me ask a question about? I think I interrupted counsel to say that the issue was not just that there was Timothy, but his brother Lawrence volunteered
yes.
these promissory notes. And I want to before I give you. Could you please start the clock again? Madam Clerk, thank you. I want to be clear to say that I wasn't trying to be flip. It struck me in context that he was trying to be helpful. This is a long-going family feud. The idea was to get it resolved. The promissory notes were brought forward, and now it strikes me as I have a lot of sympathy for the district court in viewing this as a technicality. And I don't fault you for raising the argument, certainly regarding privity, counsel, but it seems to me that there was an attempt to get this resolved and to try to settle it, and now here we are. So it wasn't just, I don't think, that Timothy was the only one involved in the litigation. Is that a fair characterization?
Is it correct that Lawrence Harris had some role in front of the account? But that's not the legal standard. Of course, the legal standard is set for Taylor. And Taylor starts with the principle that in order for a party to be bound, for an entity to be bound, it must be a party unless they are very narrow.
Although, counsel, I mean, it may not really make any difference in this case, but Taylor specifically says, the Supreme Court specifically says in Taylor, and by the way, this doesn't apply in diversity cases, right?
I don't know that they go that far to say it doesn't apply in diversity cases. I think that it is correct that that was a federal question, but it does articulate a long line of cases about what is the constitutional minimum.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there's much of a difference between Taylor and New York law, but in terms of your comments about what was going on and what wasn't, you would agree that factually, what actually went on that a trier of fact in this action could find that it was an accord and satisfaction, correct? Theoretically, factually?
I'm not sure I do agree with that. No.
So if, for example, your client were deposed and she were to say, yeah, I knew everything was going on. I knew this was submitted to the arbitrator. Me and my family members, all we really wanted to do was get credit for these notes, especially since people were challenging whether the notes were valid. So we were pretty happy that we got credit for it. If that were theoretically the testimony, that could form the basis for a court and satisfaction, couldn't it?
One of the Taylor hooks is that a party can consent to jurisdiction and consent to be bound. So if the trustee here consented to this, by way of example, if the Mundells had her sign the settlement or had her somehow manifest agreement with being made a party, then we'd have a very different situation. But that didn't occur.
Didn't the lawyer in New York, Mr. Piscarini, say that he represented Timothy Lawrence and Jeffrey in proceedings before the judge in New York?
I think there's some indication that he had a role with Lawrence, but that is different than Caroline Harris, and that is different than the Trump. And I think an important distinction here is of course, the trust. What is a trust? The trust is a legal entity with different beneficiaries. This is perhaps the most important point, that the beneficiary of the trust, of the Heinemann Trust, is Marlene Heinemann. Now, the Mundells try to sweep this away and say, well, she's progeny of the Harris family. But we can't, you know, that leads to another leap that they're trying to extend this argument to say it's sufficient that it's progeny. And so the question is not how Lawrence was affected or how Timothy was affected. It's how is the beneficiary of each trust.
Can I ask you, was there any discovery in the district court about these kinds of issues?
No, it was on a motion to dismiss.
So there was no discovery before the motion to dismiss?
Not that I'm aware of.
All right.
And nothing in the New York court that would have fleshed out how or why Lawrence was in a position to deliver these promissory notes to the accountant. Is that right?
None that I'm aware of. And I think that's a burden that the Mundell Trust bears. I mean, here's where the error, I think, is found. If the Mundell Trust wanted the Heinemann Trust to be part of this action, they needed to name them, or they needed to serve them. There are a variety of ways to put an entity. We're all familiar with them. They didn't take those steps. And because they didn't take those steps, they failed to distinguish between different entities. They use the term Harris family 69 times in the brief. And they talk about the parties agreed to a settlement agreement. The parties agreed to jurisdiction. That is very different than the Heinemann Trust agreement. And under the principle of Taylor, we can look at the narrow exception. The narrow exceptions are not, I think the district court used a broad concept saying it's an implied relationship. Taylor's clear that implied relationship, that's a virtual representation. And they say virtual representation is not enough. That's all the world constitutional due process standards. The kinds of relationships that are sufficient to bind a party are of the fiduciary. They call out class actions. They call out trustees. And they say, quote, other fiduciary. So it's not enough just that Caroline had some connection with New York action. And it, you know, the rule that the Mundells would have in court adopt seems to be if you're somewhere around a little bit, some involvement somehow, some way, the family is bound and the progeny of the family is bound. That's inconsistent with due process.
Well, counsel, I agree that that there's a, in my view, there's a problem with the way the district court decided this on a Rule 12 motion. But given what I've reviewed in the record, I think that there could be factual findings, which in this case could support your client being bound for any of the allowable ways of being bound as established by New York law that are consistent with due process. But you're not arguing that they don't get to go back and try, right?
No, correct. This should be remanded. And it is possible, we're also not asking for a finding that the Mundell Trust is bound by the notes or has to pay the notes. All we're asking is a day in court.
And what would you do with the day in court? Would the primary focus of the day in court be to show that Caroline and the Heinemann Trust were not in privity with anybody before the courts in New York? Is that the primary focus of your day in court, your trial, or your discovery?
I don't know that privity is, in fact, the correct standard. I think the district court read privity too broadly because it was basing it on virtual representation. There would be two arguments. One is that the Heinemann Trust does not fit within the narrow exceptions of Taylor. There is no fiduciary relationship that Timothy or Lawrence had to the Heinemann Trust, and there was none of the other recognized exceptions that would mean that the Heineman Trust and the Heineman Trust beneficiaries are bound. So I feel like my time is up. I'll reserve the remainder of the time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from opposing counsel.
Your honors, may please support. My name is Anthony Wise, and I represent David Mundell, who is one of the co-trustees of the August B. Mundell and Joan Webb Mundell Trust. Your honors, as you know, in this action, Carolyn Harris, in the capacity as trustee of the Harris Trust, seeks to undo the settlement of the assets of the trust that we're referring to as the 1988 Trust, relitigate issues determined in an accounting and arbitration procedure stretched out over many years, and which were eventually reduced to judgment by the New York State Court. Despite the tortured history of this matter, the facts that matter on the court's ruling below are actually reasonably straightforward. First off, we know that this matter has been strenuously litigated. The dispute has existed in the courts of New York since either 2005 or 2007, depending on when you start counting. We know that that dispute fundamentally related to the estate plans of two New York residents and a New York trust that they created in order to manage their assets and to distribute them after death to their heirs or progeny. The appellant, I just want to note, the appellant rejects the terms Harris family and Mundell family. But Joan and August apparently did not. In fact, it's important to note that that their family was a blended family. David Mundell, my client, is August's son, and Joan was his stepmom. Timothy Lawrence and Jeffrey Harris are Joan's children by a previous marriage. August and Joan were therefore very careful to set up the 1988 trust so there would always be two co-trustees.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
To get to the heart of my problem with what the district court did,
yes, Your Honor.
How is it that there, as a matter of law, no facts at issue, notwithstanding Ms. Harris's declaration, that one of the exceptions for allowing privity, one of the ways of allowing privity under whether you look at New York law or the Supreme Court case, how is it that there are no disputed issues of fact? She put in a declaration. Maybe it's not true. It would get rejected, but she puts in the trust wasn't a party, didn't have a lawyer, didn't authorize anybody, Mr. Piscionere, I'm maybe mispronouncing his name, didn't represent me, didn't represent the trust, was never engaged. I haven't spoken to him except exchanging pleasantries. We weren't even aware that this judgment was sought. I mean, how can there be a finding on a 12B motion of privity when Ms. Harris is disputing these particular facts? What specific undisputed facts establish that she is bound as the trustee?
Well, let's break that down a little bit, Your Honor. First off, I mean, I think in any situation where a res judicata is pled, a party may come back and say, no, never mind, I dispute this fact or that fact. I think what's important is what actually happened in the New York courts. And so that cuts to your, I think the more important question is what evidence do we have from the proceedings in New York that would show that Carolyn is bound to this judgment and bound the trusts?
Looking at the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, tell me what those facts are, looking at them in the light most favorable to the trustee, that shows she's bound. I'm not quarreling with your view at this point that these matters were determined, although the arbitrator's judgment on this is a little bit less than clear to me. But I'm going to assume that these were determined, that the family gets credit for these notes. What facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff demonstrates that the trustee was in privity?
Sure. So, and this really goes to Judge Jones' analysis. He identifies, I think it was four factors. The ones that Judge Jones identified in his ruling were number one, that Lawrence Harris, who's Carolyn's husband, was actively involved in the New York lawsuit.
And New York law specifically says husband, wife, that doesn't make you in privity. So go on.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor. Judge Jones noted that Lawrence Harris had provided information to assist with the accounting of the assets, liabilities, and expenses. Number three, Judge Jones focused on the fact that the information specifically included in accounting. And number four, he also focused on the fact that Timothy Harris had acted as a representative of the Harris family writ large. And this, I think this goes to the issue about the counsel, Mr. Piccioneri. And this would also be a good time to just be clear that, we believe, of course, that Judge Jones ruled correctly, but we do have another fundamental concern about the fact that this litigation is here in this court. We believe that these are issues that are better handled in the New York court, and
what issue do you think is better handled in the New York court?
Well, to the extent that the Carolyn Harris and the trust have a complaint about the amount of due process they receive, they ought to have raised that issue in the form of a motion to vacate the judgment in New York.
Carolyn Harris and the Heineman Trust were not parties in the New York action, right?
Yes, you're right, Your Honor. They were not parties, and that actually is not. You've heard from Mr. Friel a lot about that, but it goes to one of the, I'll call it, procedural oddities or realities of this case, which is that this case was litigated for approximately 3 years. The complaint was not amended, to my knowledge, but the parties ultimately reached a resolution. However, that settlement that was read into the record was a bit broader than the claims that were actually stated in the Mundell's actual complaint. And so I think that's the reason why perhaps the Harris Trust was not served with process in the first place.
Are you talking about the Harris Trust or the Heineman Trust? Aren't we?
The Heineman Trust.
Okay, so, assuming that the law is that just because your spouse is involved in litigation or aware of litigation or provided information with respect to litigation, it doesn't bind you, the spouse. And assuming that she is a trustee for someone who's a stranger to the New York litigation, Mrs. Heineman, through the Heineman Trust, how are those notes and the plaintiff appellant here in any way served by a motion to dismiss in federal court without any opportunity for discovery and possibly a trial? What's the fairness? What's the due process?
I think Judge Jones was correct, in his assessment, but assuming that's the court's concern, I think that would honestly get to the abstention argument. The same issue is currently being litigated in the New York court.
I'm sorry, what exact same issue is being litigated in the New York courts?
So Lawrence Harris has pending in the New York courts a motion to vacate the amended judgment.
Is the Harris Heineman Trust a party right now through their trustee to any litigation in the New York courts?
They are not, to my knowledge.
So
then how do you get to abstention? I that's a non-starter, isn't it?
I'm not sure I understand, Your Honor. I think because there's no act, there's no pending litigation involving the Heineman Harris Trust in New York.
Right. If we had a situation where the Heineman Trust was a party and we could say that the litigation in New York might resolve a pending issue, i.e. the Heineman Trust entitlement to payment, that would be one thing. But I don't see that here. At the top of this argument, I said that I have a lot of sympathy with the district court here. I'm a former state court judge. State court judges, I've seen a lot of really tragic family feuds that have, forgive me for referring to it that way, that have played out where they've taken years and years and years. they've destroyed relationships and consumed the estate in the wrangling. So I don't know if you all have talked about or explored the opportunity to engage our very excellent mediation service at the Ninth Circuit. You are welcome to do so. And I want to encourage you to think about that, because these questions are not, you've heard it from all three of us. How do we get to res judicata here? Right. And how do we get to abstention? What's your best shot at either one of those? I don't think I heard your answer. Maybe we didn't let you answer, counsel, but what's your best shot at privity sufficient to affirm a res judicata ruling here?
Sure. Well, it's the four factors I already mentioned that Judge Jones pointed to. There also clearly is a common interest in recognizing New York law about spouses, but there's plainly a common interest here in maximizing the recovery for the Harris family writ large. And you know, again, I know there's objection to the broad stroke phrase Harris family, but that is precisely the phrase that was used in the New York court hundreds of times, perhaps, in the opinion. So there's also the fact that can't be ignored that the Hyman Harris Trust was specifically read. I mean, in the settlement that was read on the record in the New York court.
But that only counts now, if Carolyn or the Heinemann Trust is there as a party and participating, right? So it doesn't matter. They can read anything they want into the record. If she's not present, and I don't mean literally physically present, but if she's not in the game, if she's not a party, how is she bound, counsel?
Well, that's the whole point. I think the record is sufficient to show that the trust was in the game. Now, again, because of the way this occurred out of a settlement rather than out of a court proceeding, and yep. I recognize it's unfortunate that we've gone through 16 years of litigation. If we go back in a time machine, which of course we cannot, and have that written settlement agreement, that may have provided some clarity. What we have are the representations of counsel and parties for Timothy Harris and perhaps Lawrence Harris and his brothers representing to the New York court. This is going to be a global settlement and involves an accounting of the Hyman Harris Trust.
And counsel, maybe if you don't win this appeal and there's discovery, maybe if he's still alive, Mr. Piscionaire A will testify, yeah, I did talk to Carolyn, and she said, go ahead, you're representing my interests. Maybe you'll be able to get testimony that suggests that, in fact, she was controlling or funding the litigation, or she agreed in some way to be bound, but none of that is in the record.
Your Honor, I would have to agree that Kaplan's determinations were less than concise. They were plainly written by an accountant rather than a lawyer or a judge. With that said, I think that, you know, even accepting, you know, Taylor's governing law, which I do, I think privity is not, you know, quite that constrained when you look at the circumstances of a situation like you had here. Again, keep in mind, Carolyn was supposedly, you know, taking out loans from the 1988 trust, but she you know, communicated only with Timothy Harris, that co-trustee. I mean, she was only a part of that. I mean, we also know in the record that it's the Harris side that actually has the funds, yet suit has not been brought against them by her. So I understand that's not
And counsel, I mean, just looking at these promissory notes, these quote-unquote promissory notes, you might have fabulous defenses on the merits as to why they're not enforceable. You might even have a 12B or a summary judgment motion as to why they just lose on the merits. And I share a lot of sympathy with your client's equitable position, but like Judge Kristen, I feel this case is like turning into Jarndyce versus Jarndyce and is only going to end when all the assets go to the lawyers or others. And if you do lose this appeal, I urge you all of you to focus on preserving these assets.
I couldn't agree with that part of it more, Your Honor.
Anything further, counsel?
No, Your Honor. I see that I'm basically out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your patience. Counsel, do you wish to use any of your rebuttal time?
I do, Your Honor.
Then go right ahead, please.
Okay. Counsel for the Mundells started his argument with the concept that the Heineman Trust is an undue settlement. The problem with that argument is the very problem with their entire position. The Heineman Trust is not and never was a party to the settlement.
We understand. Yeah. We understand that part of your argument.
Yeah, and so therefore it's insufficient to say the Harris family writ large, which we've referred to multiple times, is binding for the reasons set forth in Taylor. And I'll just end with the final point that Taylor requires not only a sufficient legal relationship, it says that at a minimum, representation of a non-party is appropriate if the interests of the non-party and her representative are aligned, and either the party undertook herself to be acting in a representative capacity, or the original court took care to protect the interests of the non-party. And to Judge Christensen's question, it is the case that Lawrence Harris had some involvement with the counsel, but there is no evidence, and in fact it is put in the record, evidence that he did not understand himself to be a representative of the Heineman Trust. Therefore, res judicata cannot apply in New York Act as to the. I don't have any further comments unless I'll ask questions.
I don't believe there are any further questions from the panel. No, there are not. I'll just leave you with an invitation and encouragement to not hesitate to make use of the Ninth Circuit's excellent mediators. And we'll take this matter under advisement and move on to the next case on the calendar. Our final case today is case number 20-35393. It's the Corrigan case.